Anticlimax. Somebody tell me what anticlimax is. Do not say a character in Asterix in Britain. I already know that. The word anticlimax.
Disappointment.
Thank you. That is my next word in my notes. Excellent. Disappointment. Particularly, maybe, disappointment at the end of an exciting event. Disappointment itself, very common experience, of course, isn't it? All familiar with it. Something goes wrong at the end of a day. It was a good day. Now it's taken a bad turn. You're disappointed. You've got some hopes. You think something's going to happen. You're looking forward to something. They all crash. You're disappointed. There's a difficult situation you're in. You've just taken a step forward. Looks like things are getting better. Next morning you find you've just taken two steps back. You're disappointed. Disappointment is very common, isn't it? It's a common human experience. In fact, it's so common that some with particular personalities use pessimism to try and handle it, don't they? To protect themselves from disappointment because it's going to come. You mention something to them and they'll say, oh, it's going to go wrong. Or, after it's happened, they say, I told you it would go wrong. But when disappointment occurs after a particularly exciting event, then maybe especially the word anticlimax comes into play. It can be used at other times, but that sense of, but this was going to be so good, and now it's not. Everything's gone the wrong way suddenly. An unexpected sense of being let down, left empty, after something that was so good. Christians are called to handle anticlimax well. Not to lose heart. Even to find joy in the midst of it. And today's sermon, I want to talk about why that is and how we deal with it. Because it is tough. Especially for those of us who are, by nature, pessimistic. We're going to do that from Mark chapter 9. In Mark chapter 9, you've got Jesus and three disciples initially, but then joining a bigger group. They are descending, the group of four, from a true high point. You don't really get much higher in this life. In every sense, they have been up on the mountain, what we call the Mount Transfiguration. We don't actually know which mountain for sure it was. But Jesus there was changed. He was seen as glorious. He was with two people no longer on the earth, but with God, Moses and Elijah. Those two prophets appeared, and then God himself spoke, and it was a high point. You want exciting events? You don't really get much more exciting than what the three disciples experienced up there. But now they're descending, and they're going to find that as they come down, cold water gets poured all over them. Anticlimax. So I'm going to tell the story, and then we'll give some lessons from it. Transfiguration of Jesus in the previous verses was an overwhelming event. It was so overwhelming, it left Peter, Jesus' good friend, Peter, lost in his words. He wasn't lost for words, because he's the sort of bloke who always has to say something. But he was lost in his words. He was sort of wasn't quite sure what to say, so he said the thing that came into his head. Already, Peter and the two brothers, James and John, believed in Jesus. They believed that he was the Messiah. They told him that a few verses earlier. They thought of him as the king, and the king whom God had sent, and therefore the king who was anointed with God's own spirit and power and presence. But in the transfiguration, in that moment when Jesus suddenly looked as though he'd stepped back into heaven, well, their minds just exploded with what was going on. And yet, as they come down the mountain, already there's some cold water being poured on all this. You would think that having seen that moment, it's on and upwards. But actually, as they descend, Jesus says to them, now, I want you to keep this quiet. What's just happened? As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. I don't know for certain whether that did feel anticlimactic for them. It may not have done, I guess. You know, maybe there is a certain buzz, isn't there, about knowing a secret that other people don't know. And they might have felt like that. It might be sort of, oh, right, we're the insiders. Okay. You feel special. But equally, it may have felt like, oh, why do you want to do that? And certainly as they get lower, they're going to have more of that feeling. But either way, what the three pick up on is not the secrecy. They don't say to him, oh, why is that? They pick up on another thing. The fact that Jesus says, you can talk about this eventually, but not until after the resurrection. And that is what nags at them, gets in their heads. He has already said to all the disciples back in chapter 8, I'm going to die and I'm going to rise 3 days later. But they don't still get what he means by all this language of rising. However, as they go down, they talk, and an option comes to mind. Verse 10, they kept the matter themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant, and they asked him. What do they ask him? It stems from what they've just seen. Up on the top of the mountain, when Jesus was glorified, they too saw two men. Moses and Elijah. Now, they didn't see them resurrected as such, because it seems as though Jesus actually stepped into the heavenly domain to be with them rather than they arrived on the earth. We saw that because when Peter said, oh, they've come to earth, we should put up tents for them and celebrate the great festival of booths with them, God simply swept them away. They vanished. And just Jesus was stood there looking his normal self. So, it's not the resurrection, but still, the disciples are thinking, what's he talking about? What's Jesus going on about? What's this resurrection thing? And so they start to talk and they start to think. So, there was Moses there, and Moses died. We know Moses died. God said he died, even though nobody ever saw him die. But we saw him. And Elijah, well, Elijah never did die, did he? Because he went up to heaven in that tornado thing. But we've seen him alive now as well. So maybe he's talking about them after all. Maybe something is about to happen. Maybe the conversation between Jesus and Moses and Elijah was about Jesus setting something going, giving them their marching orders. Maybe they've gone off to do something. Why would the disciples think that? Because they would at least be aware, well, they show they're aware, of the Old Testament prophets. And they know that the teachers of their day say that God has a great plan ready. And the great plan is that he's going to bring a day of judgment. And on the day of judgment, evil's going to be destroyed. And Israel's going to be saved. And the dead will be resurrected. And their minds now are racing. They're thinking, that's it. That's what he's talking about. That's why we saw Moses. That's why we saw Elijah. That's what's coming. It comes from the book of Malachi, which we read at the start. Malachi spoke of this great day of judgment the Lord would bring. Do you remember what he said at the end of his prophecy? You can look at it again later. But he said, in that day, there will be a new concern for the law of Moses. The disciples, maybe they're saying to each other, well, we saw Moses. So maybe the Lord said to him, it's time to get that going again. And then it says in Malachi, and God will send a prophet like Elijah who will reconnect the generations, fathers to their children. Well, that's like national resurrection, isn't it? It's like bringing everybody back together again. And we've just seen Elijah. Maybe it's Malachi coming true. Of course, other prophets like Isaiah, Daniel, spoke of physical resurrection. Not just resurrection in some spiritual sense, but actually bodies coming back to life. And some Jewish teachers therefore said, not all, but some Jewish teachers said, well, on God's great judgment day, when he banishes evil, there'll be a literal rising of the dead, and they're going to come back to life and have joy and peace. Well, imagine the three disciples, their heads filled with that, filled with what their teachers tell them, filled with what people like Malachi say, and now they've been on a mountain with a glorified Jesus and Moses and Elijah. It's all coming true. Jesus talked of his death and resurrection, but he meant it just as a picture. He was just saying, we're nearly at the day. We're nearly at the time. The new age is going to dawn. Which is why, verse 11, their question is, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? You can understand why they would ask it, can't you? Hang on, but you left Elijah up there. Or is he going to appear? Because he's supposed to come first, isn't he? He's supposed to come first. That's Malachi. So do you want to let us in on what you said to Elijah? Do you want to just tell us, yeah, give us the nod as to how this is going to work? When's he going to arrive? Jesus replies like this. To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. But why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? He says to them, look, sure. Yes, Elijah comes first. Yes, you're right. Yes, your teachers are right. Yes, he's going to come first. But you're missing bits of the puzzle here, boys, aren't you? You really are. You said to me, well, why do the teachers of the law say? Well, I say to you, why do the prophets say that the Son of Man must suffer? Where is that in your scheme? Why is it missing? Yes, Elijah does come first to restore all things, but why is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? You haven't put all the pieces in the puzzle together. You're focusing on one little bit of the puzzle and think that when you've done that, you've done the whole jigsaw. And you haven't. He goes back to Elijah, doesn't he, in verse 13. He says, but I tell you, Elijah has come. And they've done to him everything they wished, just as it's written about him. It's not that Elijah's on his way, says Jesus. He's been and gone. Open your eyes. What did Jesus mean? He meant that it's true that God's judgment day is coming. It's true that God is going to wipe out evil and give salvation and life to those who know him. But in order to do that, judgment day first must come on one man. On a cross, the man, the son of Adam, the son of man, him. And the Old Testament prophets said so. The disciples imagine, like many of their compatriots do, that God could arrive in a day of judgment and they'd survive. The reality is, if God arrives in a day of judgment, they all die. Because they're all lost in sin. First, there must be a day of judgment for one man, so that they can be protected and rescued. And then when the final judgment ultimately does come, somewhere further down the road, they will stand secure, they will be safe. Jesus says, come on, read the rest of the prophets. Put the other pieces of the jigsaw in place. And then he says to them, and Elijah has come. And what does he mean by that? He means John the Baptist. John the Baptist was an Elijah-like figure. And he did come and prepare the people and bring back to apply to them the law of Moses and tell them of the coming judgment and tell them how to be ready. And the nation killed him, struck him down. Chopped off his head. That was back in Mark 6, in graphic detail. The point Jesus is making is this. Yes, my friends, your dreams are good. A world judged by God, evil swept away, a new life of resurrection dawning, hope of peace, hope of joy. Great dreams. They lie at the end of a dark path. The path of the cross. And you've got to understand that. Before resurrection must come death. The death of John the Baptist, Elijah, the death of Jesus, the Son of Man. Only then can the door to resurrection be opened. So effectively he's saying to his disciples on the way down, so put your dreams on hold. And as they reach the bottom of the mountain, that just gets emphasised. When they came to the other disciples, verse 14, they saw a large crowd gathered around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. Now it's real anticlimax. From the heights of the glory of the Mount of Transfiguration, they're back at the base of the mountain with squabbling people. Such a human situation. The argument's going on with the teachers of the law. After the thrill of the top, they find the bickering at the base. It's like Moses, isn't it? You remember Moses coming down the mountain, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, back in Exodus. He gets down, what does he find? Lots of noise. What's the noise? Rave worship. Load of people dancing around a golden calf and Aaron sort of looking long-faced and saying, well, I couldn't really help it. It's such an anticlimax. Christians can do this, can't we? We can do this. We can move very quickly, can't we, from worship of the Lord with Christian people, where we're praising God for all the wondrous things he's done, 5 minutes out, we're whinging about something, having some gripe about somebody, in an argument with somebody. Very human. Very sad. Verse 15, Jesus begins to approach them with the three. And it says, as soon as the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. That's a sharp contrast with Moses, isn't it? Do you remember Moses at Mount Sinai? As he came down, he still carried glory with him and the people were scared. They were intimidated. They didn't like to approach Moses. They weren't sure what was going on with him. Jesus, his glory has been fully hidden again. What was seen on the mountain really has been subdued. He comes to them humbly. People look at him and they just go running up to him. Well, that's fine. They wouldn't have done that with Moses. They sweep confidently up to him to sort out the argument. They shouldn't have done. They're a complete disgrace. Verse 16, he says to them, what are you arguing about? Verse 17, a man in the crowd answers. You wonder, don't you? It might just be the way that played out, that the father was terribly keen to say. Or it might just be that, in fact, the teachers of the law and the disciples didn't like to say. Certainly it feels dramatic in that sense, doesn't it? That the person who speaks has to be the father. What are you arguing about? A man in the crowd answers, teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. As a father, he's brought his son. The son suffers from some form of epilepsy or similar condition. He's prone to seizures. He loses control of his body. The crowd blame it on an unclean spirit, abusing him. But it's all descended into an argument. Because the man thought the disciples would heal, and the nine disciples couldn't. Well, you can imagine how that kicked off then, can't you? You can imagine Jesus' opponents with, oh, go on then, yeah, go on then, do it, heal him. Well, so much for Jesus then. He's missing, and the guys he leaves behind are useless. So much for the Messiah. And so an argument develops. No doubt the teachers of the law are happily mocking the failure of the Jesus team, and the Jesus team are busy having a go at them and trying to defend themselves and point out all the times they have thrown out demons in the past. But they fail. Now, the next sermon, I want to talk about why that is. Why does that happen? Why do they fail? Not this sermon, though. We're going to hold on verse 19. Jesus' reaction. He looks at this crowd, teachers of the law, the nine disciples, the Father, the people, and he says to them, "Oh, unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Personally, I imagine him sighing or sort of, you know, putting his hands on his face or whatever it is. And he looks up at them and just says, you just don't believe, do you? You just don't believe. What does he mean? Jesus has taught over and over again to his disciples, to anyone who will listen, to entrust themselves to God through him. But they keep giving up on that. They just keep slipping back into other answers. They can't hold on by faith. Think of it in terms of the Exodus. It's precisely what happens in the Exodus. In the Exodus, Moses is way up the mountain. God's invisible at the top of the mountain. So we need a golden calf. We need something to help us believe. Because they don't believe the Lord. They can only trust things that they can touch, that they can handle, which are made from their power and strength. What they can make, what they can do. Something similar is going on in Mark chapter 9. While Jesus is away up the mountain, the disciples' faith fails. They try to handle the demon, but they're trying to do it in their own strength. And it all goes badly wrong. Jesus says, "You weren't believing, were you? You weren't trusting me in this. You were just, this would all become a human thing. You were going to fix the boy. And then it didn't work. So then you end up just arguing with the teachers of the law about, well, it wasn't our fault." And he says to them, "How long do I need to stay with you? I have to go soon. I've been telling you that. And you're not ready. How long do I have to stay? Will you cope? Or is this it? Is this what I'm leaving behind? A group of people who just don't believe." Such an anticlimax at the base of this mountain. Really is. You go from the high point of the Transfiguration to collapse into this human mess. You wonder about the anticlimax that Jesus himself must have felt there in his words. From displaying his glory to stupid unbelief. And I guess the three disciples were probably feeling pretty anticlimactic too. He's going away? What does he mean he's going away? Where's he going? So we're going to leave the story there. It's going to hang in the air. Do the next bit next week and follow up some of those threads. What I want to do for now though, the rest of this sermon, is just give you five applications from that. From hearing that first part of the story. Number one. Anticlimax is to be expected in the Christian life. The Lord has stated, that stuff will go disappointingly wrong for us as Christians. You remember Mark chapter 8, verse 34? He called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Deny yourself, carry your cross. Denying yourself is disappointing. You don't get to satisfy the things you wanted. Carrying a cross is disappointing. It hurts, it's miserable, it's not pleasant. Jesus offered those around him a death march, which ended with a huge anticlimax. His corpse on the cross. You know, people around Jesus were so excited by all the possibilities he brings. And he says to them, "You know what I smell? I smell death in the air. It is normal for Christians to meet anticlimax, to come down from the exciting points in our life and to feel like somebody just poured cold water all over us. To feel let down, to feel dismayed, to feel sad. It's what a cross-carrying journey feels like. Which means, point number two, you've got to pray for perseverance. You really have. Being let down can have all kinds of impacts on us, and generally does. It can make us miserable. We're just feeling rotten about everything, rotten about life. It's all miserable. Or we get bitter. I don't see why my life went this way. Other people's lives don't go this way. Other people don't have it the way I have it. They've all these lovely lives, going on, doing what they want to do, having the jobs or having the family or having the whatever it is that they want. I don't get this. Being let down can make us angry. We start lashing out, taking it out on other people, or on God, or on both. Or it can leave us hopeless. I don't know why I bother. You know, I spent 10 years doing this, got nothing for it. Don't know why I bother. One of the key lessons of the New Testament, and it is a very hard lesson to learn, you've got to persevere. Which means you've got to pray for perseverance, because you won't do it in your strength. Christians are to become people, by the help of God's Spirit, who keep going through the hits, as the Lord did. Remember what Jesus said again, chapter 8. If you try to save your life, in other words, if you try to escape the hard trials, if you try to sort of bypass them and what have you, and get the good life now that you want by chasing sort of some worldly options, you might find them. You might actually have a nicer life than other people. And you'll end up with absolutely nothing. Because everything the world can give you, whether good or bad, is temporary. It goes away. Doesn't stay. You lose it again. But if you stay with me, says Jesus, if you accept this path we walk along, even though it's a deadly path, even though it's got struggle, I promise you it leads to wonder and glory. So press on, persevere. Christians are to pray for perseverance, not to give way to the disappointment, but pray for the determination and the strength to endure. Third thing, the heart of that, the heart of what you're praying for in persevering is to pray for belief. Here in the passage we've looked at, Jesus said the problem with the disciples and with the crowd was unbelief. When life turns sour, when life goes really difficult, they threw up their hands in the air like the Israelites at the bottom of Mount Sinai and said, "Don't know what to do. Moses, he's gone so long. I don't think we can trust him anymore. We need a better answer." Despite everything the Lord had done for them, they turned elsewhere. Always the temptation for human heart. Despite everything God's done for us, there's probably something more satisfying somewhere else. I'll probably be happier with something else. I'm not giving up on God. I'm just saying I need something that makes me feel better. And we mustn't. When life gets hard, we must work on our belief. Fill our hearts with all that the Lord has done for us. Fill our hearts with all that the Lord is going to do for us. There is glory ahead. We will endure in as much as we grow in our faith. You know, Christians aren't called to be tough. Because if we were called to be tough, that would just be trusting our own strength. I need to harden up. I need to be the sort of person who doesn't get knocked, doesn't get upset, doesn't get emotional, doesn't get tearful. I need to be the sort of person who's just rock hard. That would be my strength. Christians are called to be faithful, to trust in the Lord to bring us through. Fourth thing, then, is this. Don't let anticlimactic moments, bad outcomes, whatever, steal the encouragements you do get. Take them away from you. The fact is, for all the anticlimax of coming down that mountain and being in that valley with all the bickering people at the bottom, Three disciples had seen the glory of the Lord at the top. And the mess at the bottom, although it may have felt like it cancelled that out, did not cancel that out in any sense. We can be like this. I have a good day, but the final hour of my day is horrible when something happens I didn't expect. And so when somebody asked me the next morning, how's yesterday? It was terrible. Oh, the whole thing was rotten. No, it wasn't. God blessed you for about 10 hours. And then he said to you, oh, after that nice day I gave you, would you mind putting up with a bit of pain at the end, please? But we turn it into becoming, oh, everything was rotten. In our minds, bad things often weigh heavy. In our minds, often you have to have loads of good stuff to try and balance out the weight against one bad thing. A Christian is somebody who tries not to play that game, and it's ever so hard. But we value every blessing for what it is, rather than just as a counterbalance. It's far from easy, but that's the path of faith. We believe we are walking through life with the Lord. He's not absent. He's always present. He's there in the good times. He's there in the bad times. He gives us both. And we look for the joy that he has given to us, so that even when we're in darkness, we remember the joy he has given to us. We are to expect anticlimax. We are to pray for perseverance. The heart of that is to pray for a growth in faith, belief. And we're not to lose sight of the encouragements the Lord gives. Last thing to say, and with this we'll wrap up. Biggest disappointments that you will face will be the same as the biggest disappointments that God faced. It will be people. Jesus spoke honestly about that, didn't he? He stood at the bottom of the mountain and he says to these people, some of whom he's known a long time and some of whom he's only just met, and he says, I am so disappointed in you, unbelieving generation. How long do I have to be here for you to change? The biggest disappointment you will face will be with other people. Or maybe with yourself. But here's the encouragement. The Lord Jesus then didn't say, so you lot can get lost, because I'm off. He kept working with them. Bring the boy to me. And then he works by his Spirit to change the circumstances. Let's take great hope from that. People will disappoint us, but you know what? Stubborn people can be changed by God. Troubled people can be changed by God. Sinful people can be transformed by God's grace. When a Christian feels disappointed with others, we have to remember God is deeply disappointed with us in our sin, but he keeps working with us to bring us to something better. We need to think the same. Learn to endure with other people. Don't just walk away. It's easier if I don't deal with her. If I never see her, it's so much easier. Deal with other people, ready to be honest, ready to forgive, trusting God to bring change. And in the end, you can be sure of this. When you look back on God's final day of judgment, you will not be disappointed with what the Lord has done. His kingdom will look beautiful. And you will not look back and think, what an idiot I was to try and endure through those hard times. I should have done something nicer. I should have gone and played some sport or something. What an idiot I was. You will not wake up on judgment day and have regrets about the moments you persevered with the Lord. So hold faith in him.